Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
Welcome. You are listening to Nerdette Recaps Game of Thrones with Peter Seigel. I am Greta Johnson.
And I'm Trisha Bobita, and we are joined live via satellite by our friend Peter Seigel.
Hello. 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 I'm trying to sound as if the voice is bouncing from my place where I am in California to the satellite to you. Yes, I am on vacation. I am off from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me for 2 weeks, but I would not miss this for the world, even though this episode was terrible. Spoiler alert.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
It's going to be good. Okay, today we are rehashing season 7, episode 5 of Game of Thrones, which Peter has said is terrible. I don't necessarily disagree.
Oh, my God. This was called Eastwatch, and so much happened. But first, we thought we might just remind you for a second that there is a flagship podcast that this is a sort of offshoot of, and that is Nerdette Podcast, without recaps and without Peter Seigel most of the time.
Yes, Nerdette is a podcast that celebrates the things that people obsess about. And if you haven't heard the show before, I highly recommend our most recent episode, which is all about the bassoon, which is an instrument I happened to play in high school. And in addition to speaking with two bassoon experts, we also called up perhaps the world's most famous bassoonist, Rainn Wilson, also known as Dwight Schrute from The Office. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
I never thought that I would get a call from someone saying, hey, we're doing a podcast on bassoons, and they would call me as an authority. I'm just pleased as punch. This is fantastic. It's like a dream come true.
So yeah, if you want to hear Rainn Wilson talk about bassoons, which you know you do, you should probably subscribe to Nerdette, which you can do wherever you get your podcasts, or you can find it at nerdettepodcast.com.
And just one other thing before we begin, I have a memo here.
Uh-oh.
That we received late last night from none other than Harry Strickland of Harry Strickland Partners. You might remember that Harry Strickland Partners are the very talented audio consultants that were hired between seasons of this recap podcast to kind of try to up the production value of our show. They were maybe not so great the first couple weeks, but Peter seemed to really like them last week. But then Lyle and Ginger, who you heard from last week, I don't know what happened exactly. Something to do with hot pie and some sort of coup. There was a midnight raid.
Wait a minute. So you're telling me that because I praised them last week, something bad happened to them? That will teach me. Never again will I say anything nice about anyone.
Well, I guess maybe you shouldn't, but it says here from Harry Strickland himself that he's put his two best people on retrieving the lost files. So,
well, do we have Thronesitions today? I mean, when you throw it to the first location, are we going to be able to look forward to a musical interlude so as to set the mood or not?
Well, there is no better way to find out than to begin.
After the battle,
on the Rose Road.
Fire.
Ash.
There's your answer, Peter.
Whoa. Three shows, 7, 9, and 11 for the Night Owls here at Deucex Lounge. That was, all right. I'm not going to say anything. They're trying. They're surviving over odds. They're triumphing over obstacles. God bless them.
They maybe will survive this episode. We'll see. Jaime and Bronn did pretty handily. Somehow they just get to pop up on the other side of the river.
Was that not the classic TV? Whoa. Well, that was a crazy adventure we just had last episode.
I was also really impressed with the fact that they didn't make us wait to find out any longer that Jaime was okay, right? It was like,
yeah,
end of last episode, beginning of this episode, we know he's fine, it's all good. I feel Game of Thrones from Anon would have made us wait longer for that reveal, I think.
And is that a good thing?
I think if it's moving things forward, we should call it a win. Yes.
Okay. What am I trying to say? Keep my powder dry, because there's so much to complain about in this episode, and if I just start in on that, we'll never finish. So you enjoy your instant diffusion of any tension or interest. You go ahead.
I think there is an upside in many instances.
Okay. What is that upside?
Well, I loved many things about this episode, but I think the thing that I did want to complain about a little bit, I actually pulled a clip of, which is Dany's stump speech. I think Dany's stump speech needs some work. So let's listen to basically her very bad explanation of why they should like her instead of Cersei.
Good.
That's Cersei Lannister, not me. I'm not here to murder. And all I want to destroy is the wheel that has rolled over rich and poor to the benefit of no one but the Cersei Lannisters of the world. I offer you a choice. Bend the knee and join me. Together, we will leave the world a better place than we found it. Or refuse. And die.
I think she should do a better job of explaining whether she's actually in charge because she's the rightful heir of this monarchy, or if she's some sort of strange socialist queen, which is not a thing.
Yes.
It's very confusing, this stump speech.
It was a little muddled politically. She seemed to be saying, exactly right, then I'm going to free you from the oppression of terrible queens like Cersei Lannister, but of course I'm going to punish you with death if you don't help. So yeah, it was not, shall we say, a clear message politically.
Also,
and it's interesting they didn't have any like peas and carrots of the guys going, oh, she made a point. Oh, that's pretty well. No, even the extras were like, we're not peas and carrotsing at that. Nope.
Yeah, they were also like, what wheel?
Right. That was the, it was
what?
Like, only the viewers get the wheel reference, guys. Like,
exactly.
Come up with a better way to explain this to the Lannisters, please.
They're all waving their hands going, we're peasants and soldiers. We can't afford HBO.
What
we never
wheel?
Saw that episode. We don't understand your prior invoked metaphor. Help us out here.
Yeah, it did feel mighty hypocritical also for her to be like, yeah, Cersei's a crazy queen. All right, you're going. You're done.
And you know what else was a lousy stump speech? Poor mean dad Tarly's last words.
Oh, his xenophobic racist.
But
yeah.
But it wasn't even xenophobic and racist. It wasn't like, well, she is a true-born Westerosi with the blood of you are a filthy Eastern, you know. It wasn't even mean. It was like bureaucratic. He decided to die on a principle which sounded like a senior bureaucrat turning down your appeal. It's like, well, she was born here. You, however, were not born here. It says so here in this form. Therefore, I am unable to give you the certificate of loyalty which you have requested. Good day, sir.
I guess Randall Tarly, when it comes down to it, is a DMV kind of evil.
He is. He's like, I wrote down like senior bureaucrat evil. That's all we've got.
Senior bureaucrat evil.
I'm afraid. I've looked over your application, but no. You know, anyway, sorry.
I did feel for Dicka and Tarly, who they'd gotten me to like a little bit, because mm-hmm. I was like, oh yeah, he's nice. He doesn't actually like battle. I forgot. This is Samuel Tarly's brother, who's one of my favorite characters. And then it seemed like even Randall was trying to save him from doing the dumb honor-bound thing that he was going to do, but he just couldn't do it. He just couldn't follow his father blindly.
He had one great thing before we went, which is for the last time and maybe the first time, somebody said his name without snickering.
Mm-hmm.
It was when she was pronouncing her death, Dickon Tarly, and she didn't go, which
I think it worked, though, because everyone watching snickered just a little bit.
Dickon, yeah. But and in retrospect, he did do the dumb thing, didn't he?
Dickon?
I mean, now they're both dead.
And is Sam in charge of Hornhill?
Yeah, he is. He's Lord Tarly. He doesn't know that, as they pointed out later, but we know that. There's no one left.
Yeah. He's got the sword and he's got the house. He's coming up in the world.
Little Sam.
He doesn't even know it.
Yeah. So I think next from here, we head to King's Landing because we have to follow Jaime in his muddy armor all the way to Cersei's room.
Yes, he doesn't stop to change. Oh, no.
Having lots of fun in King's Landing. Awful lot of douchebags in King's Landing.
Cersei's a terrible person.
So there used to be this bar in Hollywood, the Dresden Room. If you've seen the movie Swingers, it takes place in the early 90s. And this couple used to play there every like Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, two shows. And it was literally that. It was like the guy on, you know, and a synth and the woman singing, kind of. And that, I think that's the sound. I think that couple from the Dresden Room of 25 years ago have now shown up here. And that's exciting to me.
I was in Los Angeles like 2 years ago and I saw them there.
They're still there?
Yeah. The guy is wearing this amazing like jet black wig and he's clearly like 80 years old. And
that sounds right.
Yeah, and the two of them are there and they're playing, and I thought I had stepped into a weird movie set, but it's just they're real and they're there all the time.
They are. It's awesome.
I don't know how I feel about the editorialization taking place in these transitions, though.
What do you mean?
Do you guys find it problematic that, yeah, man, like they're calling everybody in King's Landing douchebags?
Are they wrong?
Is that true?
I mean, not necessarily, but like I've never heard an opinionated transition before is all I'm saying. I just thought it was worth pointing out that
sometimes to set the scene, you have to be morally judgmental.
Okay, so douchebags and Cersei is a terrible person. I think that does establish the tone of this location.
So Jaime has no time to change clothes. He has to go in his muddy armor all the way straight to Cersei's room, where she says, how many men did we lose? Can we just buy a new army since we have our gold? And Jaime's trying to convince her that it doesn't matter how many people they have because she has dragons.
Right. Well, it's interesting because now we know how much of the Lannister army we lost, all of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody left. So that means that Cersei is sitting in King's Landing with no army, which might be of interest to some other characters. Gosh, what else do we know? Do you think Qyburn was talking to Cersei about her blessed event impending when Jaime walked in?
Yes.
You think that's what it was? You think that he was there delivering the Westerosi equivalent of it turned blue?
No, because I think she's lying about being pregnant.
Oh.
But ooh.
She's for sure lying about being pregnant, right? Like, let's just go there. Because, you know, the only other thing that happens in between, really, is that Jaime tells Cersei that Olenna killed Joffrey, which was somewhat satisfying to watch, but it's really Jaime, like, doing some really nice acting, I think, in that scene where he goes from sort of oddly excited because you remember that he does have this weird, messed up, loving relationship in his own mind with his sister, to then terrified of her when she says, never betray me again.
While hugging him.
Yeah.
Which was the most intense hug I think we have yet seen this season.
It's a pretty dear, although we have a nice little hug coming up. Now, wait a minute. Did that conversation, Cersei saying to Jaime, never betray me again, that happened before or after Jaime's meeting with Tyrion?
Oh, it's after. It's after
Bronn
sets up the really excellent secret meeting.
Yes, the excellent secret, incredibly unlikely secret meeting.
Why? Yeah, that's where it kind of goes round the bend. I will grant you that, Peter. Go ahead.
This show went round the bend so many times. We're back where we started.
I suppose that trying to convince people to stop a war because of a zombie heist that you're going to pull.
Oh, yeah.
Is it really, bit round the bend.
Are we skipping ahead now? Because I can, but I know how you like to do things.
We'll let you get there in a minute. But here's what's happened is our typically not problematic way of going location to location worked a little easier when characters weren't bopping between them and interacting.
Right. And now that they're actually talking to each other, it's much more complicated.
Yeah, now that Davos and his little boat of fermented crab Viagra is washing up on shore in King's Landing, it makes things a little more complicated. And then, of course, in King's Landing, we have the return of the much-awaited Gendry.
Gendry. All right, hold on. We do want to register that Trisha does not believe that Cersei is really pregnant.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting hypothesis. I like it. It would make sense.
You think she's lying because there's such an obvious incentive for her to do so, i.e. to sort of rope Jaime's fortunes and interests to hers because they have a child together again.
Right.
Give them something to fight for, to echo that whole, you know, our children are dead. Well, then we'll fight for ourselves. Well, no, look, here's another baby.
No, we got a babe.
Yeah, and she knows one of her little brothers is going to kill her. And so if one knows that she's with child, maybe he's a little less likely to become the Queenslayer.
So in the elevator on my way up to work this morning, one of my very clever coworkers was like, what if she dies in childbirth? Which is kind of an interesting notion. Because that's still sort of Jaime killing her, right?
Yeah, it is. And there's an echo of Tyrion killing, quote unquote, her mother.
Exactly, yeah.
The problem is it makes so much sense from a story point of view for her to get pregnant, i.e. if she's pregnant, Jaime is sort of married to her, if not in legally, then at least motivationally, and now they have more of a stronger motivation. But it makes such sense as a story point for the show creators. It also makes sense for her something to lie about. So I don't know which one is the true version.
That was the moment in last night's episode where I was like, oh, they are just going off script. Like, I would never have anticipated that that would happen. It was just like, whoa.
Unlike other things.
So to recap, Cersei totally lying about being pregnant.
Yes. Well, in your view.
Yeah. I'm just putting money on that.
Yeah, that's clever. It's real clear.
Yeah, I can't argue that you're wrong. And it pains me. It pains me to say that.
Yeah, that's the biggest concession you've made in some time, Peter.
I know. I don't know. You may be right.
And what do you think about the meaning of the brothers, of the Lannister brothers?
We have to back up because you have to talk about the scene first at Dragonstone where they decide to do this, right? And that whole sequence.
Should we just go to Dragonstone, guys?
Yeah, we've been trying to get around it.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Colin.
What's the word?
The word is
Dragonstone.
Oh, how the terrible have fallen further.
That one sounded a little frantic.
Yeah. The place is emptying out. The manager is looking at them coldly, wondering about the people they used to bring in who don't come in any longer. We kind of have our own little tragedy here. Anyway.
So John's big dragon moment.
He gets the dragon.
It reminded me, it's like the Westerosi version of a meet cute in a dog park. It's like, oh, there's a cute girl with a dragon. I'll pet it.
Does that make this nice must dragon. Love dogs?
Yeah, pretty much.
But must love it's dragons like, with John Cusack being played by Kit Harington. Right when you think they're really going to have a moment and maybe he's going to reveal that he is also kind of a zombie, then Jorah shows up.
So they're all about to, who knows, they're going to smooch, they're going to go for a ride, they're going to jump on the dragon, they're going to sing A Brave New World from Aladdin as they fly around. Or maybe the love theme from the original Superman movie. There's a lot of scenes they could have referenced. But instead, who should show up?
Jorah.
He shows up. You look strong, says Danny. Ugh. Ooh. Hair looks good.
Ugh. It just, that guys, hug, too, was so creepily tender.
Yes. That's when you referred to the other hug in the episode. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of this one. It was like, what kind of hug is this? Is this a friend zone hug? Asking for all guys, you know?
How to read this hug?
How to read this hug. Because you know that Jorah goes to the bar afterwards and is like, well, I don't know. It was kind of a hug. You kind of turn sideways in the way that you do, but I don't know. I mean,
I don't think it's a friend zone hug, but it's a like, let's be aware of the daddy issues hug.
Yeah, clearly. We've settled those. We're not going to talk about that again. And then, of course, having traveled the literally seven kingdoms to be cured and returned to her, what does Jorah do but immediately volunteer to leave?
Yeah, that felt like an unnecessary thing except to put together our Ocean's 11 of zombie heist guys.
Exactly. how many incredibly unlikely things are these characters forced to do during the course of this episode to get the band back together?
You know, someone tweeted to us that it was like the Breakfast Club, which I really liked too. Now that song is stuck in my head.
I know, like a band of unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. So who's the? Because the Breakfast Club famously was
that's true.
Theme of the classic high school types, right? You have the nerd, the jock, the stoner, the grind, right? So who's the nerd?
Greta? Samwell, and he's not there.
Oh yeah, no. Of this group, probably John.
No,
Barrick.
Barrick? Barrick is not a nerd. He's. I hope somebody just punches him soon. But this is my great objection to this episode, why I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened on this TV show I love. It was so, what's the word, manipulative to get you that ending, to get you some of your most favorite characters together fighting beyond the wall. Isn't that exciting? And I'm like, no, it's not really, because it's all bullshit. That whole scene where they decide in the throne room at Dragonstone what to do, and everybody goes from, oh, we're fighting a war, we're trying to kill them, we just killed a whole bunch of them, to, hey, okay, that thing that John suggested beforehand, we'll do that. We'll join forces, we'll stop the war, we'll try to defeat the Night Army of the Dead. And you know what we need to do? We need to bring one of those bodies to Cersei. That will convince her, that'll be easy. Okay, who's going to go? Oh, I know. You guys go. Great. All done. Really?
Here's the one thing that I think was maybe in character and maybe felt a little more than just putting the Ocean's 11 together, which is that I think Tyrion doesn't know how to do what Varys was telling him to do, which is to get Dany to listen so that she doesn't basically just murder everyone from every one of the seven kingdoms.
Right.
And so he's stalling her. I felt like at that moment, Tyrion was just trying to stall the death of everyone he's ever known on the continent he is from.
I think you're right. I think that because of what you've just seen, and clearly they were trying to bring Tyrion to a certain place, and that place is trying to stop the war, or trying to more specifically stop Dany from killing everybody. So yeah, that makes sense. It doesn't make sense that she bought it. It doesn't make sense that she's like, oh, all right, and I will allow you, my presumably most trusted advisor, on this insane decision to go talk to Jaime in King's Landing, a place where if you are found, you will be instantly murdered in just the ugliest way. But okay, you can go.
Ooh, Trisha, I see in your notes you're calling it a white heist plan.
I am an calling it a white heist.
An elaborate white heist. An elaborate white. Ocean's 11 theme, too.
Define, Trish, white heist.
Oh, just that they're going to get a white and they're going to boost him.
Oh, white heist. I'm sorry.
I thought this.
I'm sorry. I thought this was a reference to their ethnicity, but no. Okay. Sorry. It's just the times we live in. Never. Yeah. They're going to go on the big white heist.
Yep.
We're going to need an explosives guy. Well, we got this guy. All right.
And they tried to do this by sending just a white hand to King's Landing before, but yeah. Apparently yes. By the time the hand got there, it had stopped doing the Addams Family game.
Right.
All right. So now that we are all up to speed on the white heist plan.
Yes.
Now we have the meeting of the Lannister brothers.
We'll just zig back over to King's Landing since it's so easy to do these days.
Just need a little boat and some yeah. gold to pay the gold cloaks.
So what exactly, remind me what the plan was. So they're going to go steal a white, but why did Tyrion have to go to King's Landing? Why was that so essential?
To see if Jaime was receptive to the notion of helping, right?
Right. And you see, again, is that so important that Tyrion has to risk his life and the life of Davos in order to have that conversation? Or was it just, we really needed to see Tyrion and Jaime Lannister talk at this point?
Yeah, I think Tyrion just missed him.
Yeah, they didn't need to preempt with the pre-meeting. They could have just had the meeting with the White and Jaime.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually very surprised.
If you're going to show up in King's Landing where they want you dead, wouldn't it make more sense to, at the very least, if you're going to do that, bring the thing that you know will change their mind?
Yep. Also, everyone in King's Landing knows what Tyrion looks like because he's a dwarf with a very pronounced scar.
Yes.
You know who no one in King's Landing has ever seen? Jon Snow.
Ooh.
Or Jorah Mormont.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
There's so many people in Dany's court who actually could walk through King's Landing untouched, but they wouldn't maybe get the meeting with Jaime. So I guess, yeah, we
or
have to do that.
Varys presumably still has some spies left who we could send a message, or they could send a raven, or they could do anything. But no, we needed a really cool scene between Peter Dinklage and Nicholas Coster-Waldau. So how do we do that?
We also got to use this room we built that has all these dragon heads in it. It was expensive, Peter.
It was, exactly. There were more, I think, dragon heads this time.
But we had to get back to Flea Bottom to make sure that Gendry wasn't still rowing.
Exactly, which was the opening line. I thought you were still rowing out there. Yes, us too. We all watched the show, Davos. We know, we've made that joke. Were you guys happy to see him back?
I was, although now I'm concerned that they're just going to kill him.
Really?
Yeah. There's a scene in the trailer for next week where you can see, the royal we of the internet, think that maybe we see the Hound with Mjolnir, which is the name I have given to Gendry's hammer.
Oh, sure.
All right. This is an internet snoofing bit of a preview, right?
Yeah.
You saw the Hound with the hammer.
If he's already lost his hammer, that maybe doesn't bode well for him. Also, some people got to die on this sort of quest to the beyond the wall. Otherwise, I don't know. I feel like we're going to lose at least a couple of these guys.
We're going to have to. Otherwise, it really has become Ocean's 11, where everybody's too beloved to let go.
Well, and
which is not the Game of Thrones way.
And he was such a voluntary sport to go north and help fight, you know? And the whole idea of, like, that our dads helped each other, so we should help each other. I could see that he's expendable and once he's sacrificed himself for the greater good.
And I'm amazed that nobody has mentioned this so far, but, of course, the Warhammer was the trademark weapon of Robert Baratheon, his father, right?
Yep.
So there are a lot of indications that Gendry's role in this is going to be sort of Robert Baratheon reborn. And he will be a Robert Baratheon-like figure, and Jon in this regard is going to be a Ned Stark-like figure, and they're going to fight again in a kind of lovely, happy resolution of the loss of their various fathers, which again is typical TV. You know? Well, the father was killed, but here comes the son who's just like the father, and it's going to be great when he wins. Really? I hope not.
I did kind of like Gendry making a joke at Jon, and we have a clip of that if we want to see how they became bros instantly.
Begging your pardon, Your Grace. You survived King's Landing.
Yet again.
Your Grace. This is
Prince Gendry, Your Grace. I'm Robert Baratheon's son. Bastard son.
He was meant to keep that to himself.
Our fathers trusted each other. Why shouldn't we?
I saw your father once at Winterfell.
I met yours. In my shop.
You're a lot leaner.
And you're a lot shorter.
I liked it.
I also feel like this was a reference to Kit Harington more than Jon Snow. I feel like we don't often see Jon Snow framed as being short, but Kit Harington, when you see him in interviews or on panels or anything with the rest of the cast, he's a short man. So this felt like a joke about Kit more than about Jon.
You know, I found myself wondering yesterday at that closing scene if Tormund Giantsbane is actually just normal sized, but he just seems very large he's next to Jon Snow.
It's not much special effects. That was kind of a, what am I trying to say? That was kind of another meet cute, right?
It was a meet cute. Yeah, I liked it.
Okay, it was cute. It was adorable. But do you think that Gendry is going to play a significant role in the story? Or it was just like, everybody wonders where Gendry went. He was kind of a fun character. Hey guys, let's bring him back and make him part of the team.
They needed a guy with a hammer.
Yeah, well, everything looks like a nail north of the wall, so bring a hammer.
I think he's going to die pretty quickly, but maybe the Hound will save his life, and maybe that's how he ends up off of Arya's list, because he saves Gendry, and most of the people who are on Arya's list are there because they did something bad to Gendry.
I wonder if, in fact, what we're going to see over the next few episodes of these characters is, redemption. If each of them is going to have something that they can do to complete their character arc, which will literally make me throw things at my TV if that's how they decide to go.
Uh-oh,
I know.
You need to get them some foam bricks, folks.
I know, but don't you see my point? If that's what this becomes, if these are like characters in a personal journey north of the wall, and the Hound will learn to be kind and to care about someone other than... Oh, God, please.
The Hound already has learned to be kind and care about other
people. Yeah, that's easy. But I'm concerned that he'll have to learn more. Please don't learn anything.
No learning?
No learning.
Leaders
no growth.
Against learning.
There was actually a famous story when they created Seinfeld that Jerry Seinfeld said to his close, Larry David said, on this show, there's not going to be any learning. No growth. Nobody gets hugs. That's what they meant. They didn't want, the whole point of this long journey north of the walls was Sandor Clegane could learn to care. No, we don't want to see that.
Is that what defeats White Walkers, though? Is it Valyrian steel and love. Care bear
and
stare?
And love. It's
exactly.
Love.
The love in your heart. Oh,
the love of a
God.
Mother sacrificing herself for her son.
All right.
So again, to say it, all of this is happening because clearly the showrunners want it to happen rather than anything it seems organic to the characters, and I am cross.
Everybody quiet, because Peter Sagal's got another goddamn opinion.
I'll have you know that was producer-initiated.
I'm sure. He's getting the rhythm of it.
All right, more in just a minute.
You've got a friend. Call him anytime you please.
He saved a dude from infectious disease.
You can trust him. He's a worthy clientele.
Sam Tarly. You can find him at the Citadel.
We got rhymes.
Yeah, I know. It took 4 or 6 minutes of music till we got our first one, but there's a rhyme. I saw it. I heard it.
Oh, boy. Harry Strickland partners.
This couple are growing on me. I feel I'm getting to know them as people.
Oh.
Their story is sad, but kind of hopeful.
That seems about
Which
right.
Which is something that you're tolerant of in your Thronesitions, but not your Game of Thrones.
Exactly. They can invoke whatever cliche they want.
So we're at the Citadel. The maesters are gossips. And they're all sitting around discussing this letter they got from the north, right?
How foolish. This true information in front of me is, let's all look at each other, chuckle, and dismiss it.
I turned on closed captioning during this scene to make sure that I knew what they were murmuring about near the end. And it was old Jenny of Old Stones.
And Lodos.
And then, of course, I went down internet rabbit holes about who each of them were, which were kind of fun nods to book readers, I think, because they are real things in the books. But
Lodos. That was my
favorite. No, Lodos.
Jenny of Old Stones.
So the next scene in the Citadel is perhaps much more instructive for us.
It is.
Gilly's very important summer reading list.
Yeah,
yes.
I think several people asked that we play a patriarchy jingle on behalf of Gilly because Sam is just so resistant to actually listening to her imparting important information. So can we make that happen, Justin?
Nobody cares, but it never really stops him.
It's Sam Will Tarly.
So fucking talking.
Thank you, Trisha.
Thank you.
I had to do the edit on the fly. This isn't your fault, Peter. This is Sam's fault.
To be fair to Sam, and I feel like I need to defend him in this moment, it wasn't that he was dismissive of Gilly, it's that he was very angry and thus distracted. So it wasn't like he was saying, stop talking to me, Gilly, you silly woman. I've got more serious things to think about. But clearly he was upset. We've
also
all been
I
there.
Think thinking about maesters and their bowel movements just really put him in a PTSD moment.
So it did it.
He doesn't have, you know, he's lots of reasons to be mad. And he just went through that classic thing where nobody listened to him, even though he was telling the truth and he was dismissed. I don't blame him for being mad. However, he should have listened to Gilly saying, oh, let me tell you about this interesting word I've just learned. Annul. There was this guy named Rhaegar once who had his marriage annulled.
Yep.
Is annulment a thing in Westeros?
And apparently it is, according to Septon Maynard, yes.
Yep. In the Light of the Seven, it's not common to have a divorce or an annulment, but as we know, when you're royal, the rules that a faith puts on other people don't apply to you in such matters often in history. So
what this means then for the story is the annulment is that there are two things. First of all, now somebody else knows, other than Bran, if somebody would just pay attention to Gilly, what Rhaegar did. And who Jon Snow is, but also that Jon Snow is legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
He is the legitimate firstborn son of the legal marriage of Rhaegar and Lyanna Stark, meaning he is the heir to the throne.
The real heir, and since Dany is always talking about the fact that she gets the throne because Targaryen,
right.
that
right.
means that she's going to have to bend the knee.
Oh, that would be
yes.
so delightful.
Or, and we remember, we've talked about this many, many times, the Targaryens have a tradition of incestuous marriage, in much the way the pharaohs of Egypt did. So there's nothing to prevent because the other thing that's going along is this impending romance between the two of them. I mean, like that meet cute in the cliff with the dragon, you know?
Yeah.
Let me just tell you something. When a guy's like petting a girl's dragon, in his mind, he's not petting her dragon, if you know what I mean.
Ooh. She does have a look on her face that was pretty interesting in that
yes.
scene.
So I'm saying that there's nothing to prevent, we didn't learn anything that would prevent that particular storyline from taking place, given the Targaryens' ways.
And now Sam has run away from the Citadel. I think
Did you
the
feel
saddest,
bad?
The saddest I was the whole season so far was when Sam looked back at the library that disappointed him and
yeah.
walked out.
I was thinking, I was actually not so much thinking about Sam, I was thinking about you, Trisha, knowing how sad you were. Can't leave that library.
I mean, knowing that the Citadel didn't accept women as maesters, I was already sort of over it once we realized what a patriarchal bunch of nonsense they were.
Yeah, I know.
But, you know, knowing that about the Citadel felt a little bit like the great Lindy West quote, which I'll paraphrase, which is, feminism is realizing that everything you ever loved hates you a little bit. That's how I felt about seeing the Citadel in action.
There was also a specific invocation of the hidden secret theory, which you, Trish, have mentioned many times in your hopes of what Sam would do, which is he'd go to the Citadel and he'd find buried in a book somewhere the secret to defeating the White Walkers, and thus he could participate in the ultimate victory in his own nerdy way, just like the more brave characters will be hitting things with swords, right? That was your big hope?
Yes.
Well, that was specifically invoked when Sam says, you know what you could do, maesters? You could look in all the books and find that little bit of information that we know is out there that will help us defeat the Night King once and for all. And they were like, no. And then what do we see him doing? We see him grabbing books, apparently almost at random.
Yeah.
but what are the odds that one of those books has that one piece of information that everybody has forgotten about but will allow them to, in fact, defeat the forces of evil?
So
I would say the chances are pretty good.
So is he going to be at Winterfell next week?
I don't know. They can get anywhere they're going whenever they want, right? This is like the new rules. It's like, oh, let's go there. Zip.
I think, he would go to Winterfell, probably not Eastwatch, because he doesn't know they're at Eastwatch.
Right. Well, where does he think? Well, the Raven just came, right? So he must know that.
He knows
is John
that Bran is at Winterfell. I don't know that Raven says anything about where John is, actually.
I would agree with you that the most likely place we will see Samwell Tarly is Winterfell. Or do you think he'll pop up at Eastwatch when just they're in trouble all of a sudden? You know,
yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. Yeah.
He'll pop up and say, I brought this weapon or something like that.
Even if he goes to Winterfell, he can still get from Winterfell to Eastwatch within an episode.
Clearly.
They can get anywhere they want.
Exactly.
Should we then go to Winterfell?
Yes, let's go to Winterfell.
Now it's time to talk about
Winterfell.
I always think the Winterfell ones are the most charming for some reason. That was
including this week?
Including this week, yeah. Winterfell.
That
Winterfell.
One felt like Sesame Street to me.
Oh, maybe that's why I liked it.
So in Winterfell, an elaborate scheme run by Littlefinger, he's finally doing something. He seems to have noticed growing tension between Arya and Sansa. Tension that is reflected in a scene in which they argue about what exactly?
I guess Arya wanted Sansa to be more strict with the lords about their respect of King Jon.
Right. And he was like, no, or what exactly? I mean, it just seemed like they were fighting for the sake of fighting. That Arya had taken a position which was opposite of her sister's on something just to, so they could have some conflict.
It did feel a little bit like a sister fight.
Of which you guys have more experience than I.
Oh, no.
No,
neither of us have
sisters.
Brothers, so yeah.
Really? Neither of you have sisters?
Nope. We just are sisters.
Oh, I see. So define sister fight for me in that regard.
Well, it would have to be two sisters, I think. I don't know. Having a brother, I always just see sisters and I'm like, oh man, that's got to be really tough.
Really?
I just feel like girl sisters. I mean, and you know, some of them can be very nice to each other. I just feel like sometimes they can be very mean to each other too. And I think Sansa and Arya, they've got that. There's tension there, you know? They know how to hurt each other really well.
That's true. And they also did not like each other very much. They didn't get along well very much when they were much younger before all this happened. But I still don't understand, especially since it seems like what Littlefinger is up to, that he wants to drive a wedge between them for reasons of his own. Maybe you guys can explain. Why would he want to do that? It does seem as if they just needed to have some conflict because I didn't see exactly what the problem was from Arya's perspective of what Sansa had just done.
Well, essentially Arya's accusing Sansa of plotting to take Winterfell for herself, right?
She is accusing Sansa of that. I think she's also accusing Sansa of being politic now as opposed to what Arya understands, which is pretty much only getting what you want through force and fear and violence.
Doesn't
and Sansa's
Arya
a good
make...
politician, but Arya doesn't understand that world. That's not the world she was raised in. That's the one Sansa was raised in.
Right. And doesn't Arya make some suggestion of violence? Like, well, they behave if you just, you know, whack their heads off or something.
Yeah.
Yes, we have that, actually. Let's take a listen.
I'm sure cutting off heads is very satisfying, but that's not the way you get people to work together.
And if Jon doesn't come back, you'll need their support. So you can work together to give you what you really want.
How can you even think such a horrible thing?
You're thinking it right now. You don't want to be. But the thought just won't go away.
I think a little bit of this is just them working through some of their issues.
Yes.
And what Littlefinger needs to understand is that sisters fight like this, but it is always ovaries before broveries. Mm-hmm. You better watch out.
Yep, for sure.
You think? So
clearly...
It seems then that we can understand that Arya suspects that Sansa is plotting to take Winterfell for herself or to supplant Jon, which is a pretty big leap of supposition, really, just based on what we've seen. I mean, specifically, didn't we see Sansa in that throne room or the Great Hall defending Jon to the knights? The knights were saying, well, you should be in charge. And she's like, no, Jon's in charge.
I mean, she says Jon's doing what he thinks is right, which is a pretty weak actual support. You know, it's like he's doing what he thinks is right.
If a vice president says that about their president, then you're like, oh, that guy's running against him.
I see. Do you buy Sansa as this kind of enlightened ruler? As if, I mean we saw her sort of magically figure out how to do logistics recently. Has she magically figured out how to be an effective leader of a cooperative team?
If so, then she's the only one in Westeros.
Right. What has she learned? What does she know? I mean, she's someone who grew up with her head filled with fantasies and tales of knights and knights errant and maidens, right? We knew that. She was complete naive. And then she went through X number of years of absolute horror, which would have warped anybody given what she went through. And now suddenly we're supposed to believe she's sort of has this natural command where she knows what to do to get people to, she gives a little speech. This is how you get people to work together. How would she know?
Well, I think it's fair to assume that it's not by cutting off people's heads.
Yes.
Right? I mean, like,
yes.
She at least does know that much in her defense.
Right. Well, although someone who's been through what she's been through, being traumatized as she was by Ramsay over the years, wouldn't she, her more natural learned opinion be, you have to be incredibly mean to people before they're incredibly mean to you? I mean, how does she come out of, I guess what I'm saying is, how does the character that we have seen develop over these many years end up having these opinions and these skills? It's hard to see.
I think that some people learn by example and others learn by example to do the opposite, right?
What not to do?
Yeah.
Counter example.
Yeah. And Sansa and Arya are kind of doing that, right? Like if you have, you know, a parent who treats two children the same way, one will follow in exactly those footsteps and the other one will run in the other direction. And
yeah,
I think
that's
kind of what we're seeing with these two girls.
I think that, you know, one of the things, this is hard for me to articulate, one of the things that I think we're seeing happen is that characters are succeeding or failing or taking actions because of an inherent quality, right? And you saw that most clearly this episode with Gendry, i.e. you don't really know anything about Gendry, except we're being told because he's his father's son, he's brave, he's strong, he's devoted and loyal, will fight by your side, and he's pretty good with a hammer, right? We're just being told that's who this guy is. Enjoy. And it seems like we're being told, well, that's who Sansa is now. She's kind of enlightened and sophisticated in a way that we haven't seen her be or learn to be. She just is.
But next week, I think she's afraid of something because Arya seems to say to her, are you afraid?
Oh, in the upcoming episode?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And should we just mention for folks, in case they haven't Googled it for themselves yet, what was on that raven
yes,
that was
please.
So artfully hidden?
Oh, yes. Tell me what was on that raven. So which raven message are we talking about?
The one that Littlefinger hides in his mattress for Arya
right.
to find.
Yes,
which is,
and she pulls it out and opens it up, and you could freeze frame it and read it?
You can,
it's
and
a
also...
a little blurry around the edges, but
oh,
yeah.
it's clear what it is, I think.
And what does it say? What does it say?
It is the one that she was forced by Cersei to write to Robb Stark in season one about Ned being a traitor and Robb needing
right.
to come to King's Landing to bend a knee.
Right.
And at the time...
Yes.
Robb and Maester Luwin both agree that it was Cersei's handwriting, but the words of the queen. But
right.
Arya doesn't know that, really.
You mean Sansa's handwriting, but the words of the queen.
Yeah, yeah.
So, in other words, like they understood that Sansa was being forced to do that on point of death or whatever. But Arya probably won't.
At least at first.
Right. So Arya is going to end up, if this manipulation succeeds, believing that her sister Sansa was, in fact, in league with... what's his awful name, Joffrey, and responsible for their father's death.
And
that
Rob's
would be bad
death,
for their...
And their mother's death.
God.
I mean,
oh,
really,
boy,
it sets
everybody.
All of that in motion. It sets Robb going south into motion.
Right. So they're basically going to be at odds. You feel?
That's Littlefinger's plan, but I refer back to my previous statement, ovaries before broveries.
Right.
I don't think he's actually going to get between these sisters. And Bran should be able to sort this out, right? Like, they do have an all-knowing brother, like, one room over.
Right. They have an all-knowing brother, and we sort of skipped this because it was early on in the episode, I think. We have an all-knowing brother who has decided to make himself useful.
Right.
For once.
He's weighing in.
Who's weighing in, who's doing the things that we were asking, why isn't he doing those things? Why isn't he, like, borging into ravens and doing some intelligence? Well, he did those things. Why isn't he actively helping the good guys? Well, now he's actively helping the good guys.
I also did really love the Arya lurking montage.
The lurking on lurking, the Arya
uh-huh.
lurking and the Littlefinger lurking
yeah,
on Arya
yeah.
lurking.
It was just a lot of lurking without much
just,
actual dialogue.
They were lurking at each other.
It was mutual lurk.
God, no, it sounded creepy.
We have just one more location, which was fun to see in the opening credits, I have to say. The little animated version
oh,
of this
I loved
watch
it.
Was cool.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, look, it's a new one. I love when new locations show up in credits.
I'd like to thank you all for coming out to the wall tonight. And without further ado, I'd like you to put your white walking hands together for Jen.
Wall. Ice cold. Wall. Tall wall. I walk on the wall, I walk around the wall, I fall off the wall, don't fall, wall, don't fall, wall.
Oh God, it's word jazz.
I was tempted to leave, you guys.
I know. I think we may have, as is appropriate to the wall, plunged off the end of the world.
We're no longer at the Dresden. We're at some other other very different bar. Oh boy. Now the supergroup is complete.
Yes. And so many cliches were invoked, including the ones of finding the last members of the team in a cell. Right?
Yeah.
How many times have you seen that where it's like, well, what happened to the Biff, the explosions expert? Cut to, you know, cell Jill Block where he's lying there waiting for the other guys to come. Yeah, we got him. Here he is. We got to get him out of jail, though. We have to have some badinage first. So the notion that the Hound, Thoros of Myr, and Beric Dondarrion all just sort of saw that vision a couple of episodes ago in the flames. And they were like, okay, we got to go to the wall.
Yeah,
that's it.
They saw the wall and they saw the Arrowhead Mountain and they follow the Lord of Light.
Yeah, man, I feel like people have done way crazier things because they saw things in flames than in this specific instance.
This is true, but they seem so obedient. It's like if it showed them an Applebee's, is that where they'd go?
I mean,
I guess so. But so we just needed everybody at the wall. So who go down the roster of our now assembled supergroup.
Roll call.
We have Jon.
Yeah.
We have Jorah.
Yeah.
We have the Hound.
Uh-huh.
We have Beric Dondarrion.
Yes.
We have Thoros of Myr.
Yes.
We have Gendry.
Yes.
And we have Tormund Giantsbane, who is very disappointed that Brienne is not there.
Yes. Is the giant woman here? So that's our team of heroes from various points in this season.
Mm-hmm. And some red shirts. They were then followed by some red shirts.
Oh, really? I didn't notice that they had red shirts.
Yeah.
They must know. I mean, they're looking around at these other characters going, wow, these are some of the most beloved characters of our TV series. Aren't we lucky that we get to go with them? Can't wait to talk to Jorah Mormont there about his scenes in season one. They were very exciting back then.
They did talk to Tormund about needing some of his men.
Yeah, some of the free folk.
Yeah.
I think we should maybe tell the show watchers something that only the book readers probably understood also, which is why Jorah and Thoros know each other.
How did Jorah and... Oh, they used to fight together back in the East when they were both
listeners.
Yeah, they
together. Yeah. So Thoros of Myr took Lightbringer, his flaming sword, which we're going to see next week, according to the trailer, into Pyke. And that's where Thoros of Myr and Jorah Mormont had their sort of epic battle. I think that's how Jorah was made a knight initially.
Yeah.
So they have history that actually has never been in the TV show that they referenced in this episode. Because all these guys now have a bunch of history with each other. Either somebody killed somebody in their families, or they fought together 9 years ago
or
something.
Got kidnapped. Or, yeah.
Did they all, I have to watch the scene again. Did they all talk about that? Oh, I know you.
Yeah,
Thoros of Myr.
Sure.
We fought in Pyke. There was a lot of nods of recognition.
Well, they didn't mention Pyke, but there were, what was it? Was it the showrunners who called it like enmity ping pong or something?
Yeah.
Because they were all just sort of like, oh, I don't like you. I don't like you either. And then the conclusion is, how do we know we're all on the same side? Because we're all breathing.
Right.
Which I did think
so have we gotten to the end? Have we fought our way through this heavy in exposition, manipulative of characters, and generally unsatisfying episode of TV?
See, man, I really liked it, but I like really talky TV like this, so I was kind of into it. But
because I was so disappointed. I will tell you the truth. I was so disappointed. I went to bed last night going, what am I going to say in the recap? I'm just going to be bitter and unhappy. There will be no joy for anyone in me today. I was feeling bad. So I want you, Trish, to convince me that I was wrong, and this is actually a great episode.
Well...
I think it was a useful episode in terms of moving things forward, right? I mean, we've talked about this before. You have to have these episodes in the grand chess game where pieces are moving around so that the crazy shit can happen in episode 6.
Yeah.
And I think it did exactly that. I mean, the fact that we only have 2 episodes left this season is insane and mind-blowing. And when my mother found out the other day, she called it coitus interruptus, actually. She was pretty upset about it.
I know. I just like your mother's school of metaphors.
Yeah, I guess I would say that I understand why you're disappointed. And I was just able to just decide in my head that this was a different kind of thing now. And because I think I don't have the backbone of the books as ingrained in me, it's less different. Like the pace of it. I've talked with friends who are book readers, too, and they're like, but the early, slower days of the show remind me of the pace of the books, and
right.
So I like them more, and this feels more like TV, and I'm the kind of person who likes talky, fast-talking TV more than I like really long books.
Oh, really? I had no idea. You,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You like TV shows in which people walk down corridors and talk rapidly. Is that what you're saying?
Or that's like Stairways and Dragons.
Or Stairways.
Yeah.
So I understand why you're disappointed, but I had popcorn in hand last night and was kind of like, no way. Now they're together? And they're going to do what now? And he has a hammer? Like, I just...
Yeah.
I kind of was into it, man.
I think you just have to let your brain break just enough and then just go with it. And then it's, like, still a pretty fun ride, you know?
You know what? I realized, even as we finished this week and looking at my attitude, I realized that I am Randall Tarley. Like, you're all going like, oh, let's go with it. It's everything's changed and this is cool and now we have dragons. And I'm like, no, this is not allowed. I'm sorry. But the rules are you can't do that on this TV show, and I'm sorry, I just can't go along with it. And then I guess I get burned to death. I guess that's appropriate fate.
Just bend the knee, Peter. Bend the knee to the trite TV writing.
I refuse.
Okay, we are going to listen to some voicemails in just a moment. Okay, time to listen to some voicemails. First up, we have Amanda from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, this is Amanda calling from Portland, Oregon. First-time caller, long-time listener. I'm just curious if you guys have any insight on the, like, crazy badass crew that's heading to find some White Walkers. If there's going to be, like, any infighting after all the shade that was thrown this last episode, given all the different characters that are going out there together. Can't wait for the episode tomorrow. Thank you so much. Take care. Bye.
Peter, would it make you happy if the Super Friends ended up with some infighting problems and killed each other? Would that make it better?
I was just thinking that. I mean, it's hard to imagine that any one of them is going to, like, pull a Telly Savalas in the Dirty Dozen and turn on them, because that's probably not going to happen. But I imagine that any conflict that happens, right, arguments between Sandor, who's a jerk, and Jon Snow or whoever it may, but it's all going to be just time-killing conflict to give us good badinage before they're attacked and they need to start fighting together. It's hard to imagine that anything really interesting is going to happen between those characters other than bickering and then fighting and dying. Yeah, and I'm absolutely certain, by the way, that more than one of them is going to die. I mean, we can start, you know, picking our favorites to go.
Should we put money on that? I mean, not actual money, but should we make some?
What I don't know.
Only Jon makes it back with Lightbringer, the sword that's on fire, because he's the prince who was promised. What if only Jon makes it back? Does that make it okay that they, like, teased everybody with a Super Friends superhero movie thing if they just murder everyone?
Well, the one argument, I mean, there's all of those characters have survived. I mean, Jorah, Sandor Clegane, and certainly Beric Dondarrion, all of those guys have survived prior deaths of a kind. They're all assumed to be dead or dying. And now they've all gotten a second chance. And usually what happens to characters who've been given a second chance is they die nobly the second time. Right? Isn't that the classic idea? Like, you've been saved from the death for some purpose, and your purpose is to save Jon Snow's life or to save the Seven Kingdoms through some act of bravery. So I think Beric is going to be the first to go because he's the one we have the least connection to, and he also has that kind of "we must do this." He's often the leader whose sense of mission brings him first to doom. And I think I've been waiting for Jorah to die for 3 seasons. So any day,
so
guys,
happy if Jorah died.
Any day, guys.
Also, they might all die of not wearing hats or earmuffs because come on, guys.
Oh, God, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the head covering is problematic, to say the least.
No, but we've talked about this before, that none of these people, no matter however freezing it gets, ever put on a goddamn hat.
You would think Tormund, at least, would be the one who would be like, everyone, guys, put on a goddamn hat.
Have you not been here before?
All right, one more voicemail. This is a fun one. I actually want to hear what Peter has to say about this, because I don't know.
So our question is, how is it that the Maces don't know anything about the Three-Eyed Raven? Interesting.
That is a good question. And I guess the answer has to be that that's something that is only known to the mystics of the North. I mean, how did like Bran find out that the Three-Eyed Raven existed? Through his visions, right?
Yeah.
After his accident. And as far as I remember, his maester, the people who raised him, who was the original maester at Winterfell?
Lewin.
Thank you. Their attitude was, you know, all of that nonsense, the White Walkers or the others, as they're called in the book, it's all nonsense and just legends. Don't worry about it. So presumably the Three-Eyed Raven would be part of that magical world.
I do wonder, though, if the Three-Eyed Raven has always existed since the first men and the children of the forest, sort of the Dread Pirate Roberts thing that we've discussed, that there has always been one.
Right.
If he wasn't involved in ending the last long night, like, is that the thing that they'll find, is sort of like what the Three-Eyed Raven is actually supposed to do?
Hmm.
I don't know. Maybe that's something that Sam can find out. Because it does seem strange that nowhere in the Citadel is there ever any meaningful reference to this Green Seer. Because they believe in warging and green sight and these other things, right? Like they...
Do they?
I don't know. I mean, is it all sort of pre-written record and all seen as legend?
My guess is that the maesters are supposed to be representing what passes for rational science in Westeros.
Right.
So they're the science guys who believe in cause and effect and believe in, you know, evidence. I mean, remember, we even saw Maester Broadbent, conducting kind of medical experiments as he weighed organs and stuff.
Yeah.
So presumably, if they're set up that way, like they're the rational forces of knowledge, then they're going to poo-poo, as we saw them do at magic, ESP, all kinds of, you know, supernatural stuff.
Okay, we have an extra bonus voicemail.
Hey, this is Kevin from San Jose. Just really, really short. If you want to be my lover, you got to go with my Drogon.
Wow.
God bless our listeners. God bless them all. I do like the idea, though, of what of Danny being what? Dragon spice? I don't know.
Dragon spice. Also, is he auditioning for Harry Strickland Partners? Is that what was happening?
Oh.
Did Harry Strickland appear among the captured... no, wait a minute. Not Harry Strickland. Ned Sheeran. Did Ned Sheeran appear among the captured...
Ed Sheeran.
Not Ned Sheeran. That's Ned Stark. Ed Sheeran appear among the captured Lannister soldiers? I thought I saw his little beardless face.
Oh, I missed that. If so, that would have been exciting, but I feel like the internet would have, right?
Yeah. Did you guys find out about Noah Syndergaard last week?
Find out about what?
You didn't know about this. That in there was another famous cameo in last week's episode, that the Mets pitcher Noah Syndergaard had a literally second and a half cameo as a Lannister soldier throwing a spear.
Aww.
That's delightful. I love baseball and Game of Thrones. How did I miss this?
I don't know. I missed it too. And somebody said, hey, did you hear about Noah Syndergaard? I was like, I would have heard about that. But no, there he is. Look it up.
But did you guys hear about IKEA?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Jon Snow's capes are actually IKEA rugs.
Yes.
Which I just find delightful.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense when you think of like those big outfits that like the Bear Mormont used to wear, you know.
Totally.
Those enormous, you know, thick pelts. Why not IKEA rugs?
Yep. No, it's perfect. It's perfect.
So if you have questions for us, or you feel we've missed something, like baseball players or IKEA rugs,
or Arya's left-handedness or not, we got a lot of comments about that last week.
Oh, yeah. A lot of back and forth about her left-handedness. And many people wrote in, so now we know.
Now we know. Maisie Williams is right-handed. Arya is left-handed.
Call us and tell us things that you know or questions that you have. 312-948-4687 or a toll-free number, 855-923-9993. We're online at wbez.org/thrones. We're on Twitter at NerdAtPodcast or at Peter Sagal. You can use the hashtag GOTNerdCaps.
Thanks to Michigan Shiel for writing us a nice review on Apple Podcasts. Michigan Shiel says, if you like smart, funny women and a man who is constantly surprised when his patriarchy reveals itself, this is the podcast for you.
I'm not surprised, per se. I see it coming.
I don't know if that makes it better or worse, but that's okay.
The show is produced by us with help in so many ways, including being fast on the button that has those patriarchy jingles on it. Thank you, Justin Bull.
Our executive producer is Joel Meyer, and our theme music was composed by Andrew Edwards of Blue Police Box Music. Let's just be clear, he has nothing to do with the Thronesitions.
Nothing. Totally innocent.
But an extra special thank you this week to someone named Rob Wildebor, who is the keyboardist for Harry Strickland Partners.
I knew it was him.
Lay us out, Rob.
It's the next place.
The next place we're going.
It's the next place.
Another place.
It's another place.
A different location, presented by
Harry Strickland Partners.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.